Welcome to this week's Ortho Digest Rundown for August 3rd, 2026. This week, we indexed 491 new orthopedic studies across 34 journals. The 75 highest impact studies are featured on the site, and we're covering the top 25 studies in this audio digest. As always, studies are ranked by our impact algorithm, which weighs journal tier and level of evidence. Let's start with our first study. Reutz and colleagues published in the Journal of Arthroplasty, titled 10-Year Outcomes of Hypoallergenic Coated and Standard Implants in Total Knee Arthroplasty, a randomized controlled trial. This randomized controlled trial compared 10-year outcomes of hypoallergenic coated versus standard total knee arthroplasty implants in patients without known metal allergy undergoing unconstrained primary total knee arthroplasty. Both groups achieved identical 98% implant survival with one revision each, and showed no significant differences in Oxford Knee score, SF-36 quality of life score, or patient satisfaction at 10 years. Serum metal ion levels were below detection limits in both groups at 5 years, with no between group difference. One limitation to note is that exclusion of patients with confirmed metal allergy means the study cannot answer whether coated implants outperform standard implants in the highest risk allergy confirmed population for whom coating is most clinically justified. Moving on, Dee and colleagues published in the British Journal of Surgery, titled Autologous Impaction Bone Grafting of a Cemented Acetabular Component in Primary Total Hip Arthroplasty in Young Patients, a randomized controlled trial. This single-center, triple-blinded randomized controlled trial randomized 131 patients aged 18 to 59 undergoing primary total hip arthroplasty without acetabular defects to cemented cup with or without autologous impaction bone grafting, with WHO's ADL at 1 year as the primary non-inferiority endpoint. Impaction bone grafting met non-inferiority criteria with a mean difference of 1.9 points, 95% confidence interval, -4.85 to 8.7, and showed no difference in other patient-reported outcome measures or complication rates, but added 7.5 minutes of operative time and 100 milliliters of blood loss. The impaction bone grafting group demonstrated significantly fewer radiolucent lines at the bone-cement interface and a less superiorly and medially displaced center of rotation postoperatively. One limitation to note is that one-year follow-up cannot determine whether the reduction in radiolucent lines translates into improved implant survival, which is the primary concern in patients under 60 who face the highest lifetime revision burden. Liao and colleagues published in the Journal of Arthroplasty, titled Liposomal Bupivacaine versus Ropivacaine with Perineural Dexamethasone in Adductor Canal Block for Total Knee Arthroplasty, a randomized clinical trial. This randomized controlled trial randomized 72 primary unilateral total knee arthroplasty patients to single injection adductor canal block with liposomal bupivacaine plus bupivacaine HCl versus ropivacaine plus perineural dexamethasone, with the primary endpoint being incidence of moderate to severe pain with movement at 48 hours. The primary endpoint was not met, with rates of 47.2% versus 63.9%. Secondary outcomes favored liposomal bupivacaine, lower numeric rating scale scores at rest and with movement at 24 and 48 hours, reduced opioid consumption in both the 0 to 24 hour and 24 to 48 hour windows, and improved quality of recovery scores at both time points. One limitation to note is that the trial was underpowered for its primary endpoint, with a wide confidence interval that cannot exclude a clinically meaningful reduction in moderate to severe pain with movement, favoring liposomal bupivacaine. Ramey and colleagues published in the Journal of Arthroplasty, titled The Influence of Total Knee Arthroplasty Surgical Approach on Range of Motion, Patient-Reported Outcome Measures, and Reoperation Rates, a systematic review of randomized controlled trials. This systematic review of 27 randomized controlled trials published between 2010 and 2024 compared total knee arthroplasty surgical approaches on range of motion, patient-reported outcome measures, and reoperation rates. Of 25 range of motion studies, 7 favored a quad-sparing approach, including 3 subvastus, 2 midvastus, and 2 mini-medial parapatellar approaches, while 18 found no difference. of 26 patient-reported outcome measure studies, 7 favored a non-standard approach, while 19 found no difference. No approach demonstrated consistent superiority across all 3 outcome domains. One limitation to note is that absence of patient-level meta-analysis prevents determination of whether subgroup populations, such as obese patients, stiff knees, or those at revision risk, derive differential benefit from any specific approach. Moving on, Rim and colleagues published in the British Journal of Sports Medicine titled Hydrodilatation for Adhesive Capsulitis, a systematic review exploring efficacy and optimal technique. This systematic review with meta-analysis evaluated hydrodilatation versus corticosteroid injection alone and versus physical therapy across 103 studies. Hydrodilatation showed a statistically significant but clinically modest external rotation advantage over corticosteroid injection alone, with a standardized mean difference of 0.61, and marginal pain and shoulder pain and disability index improvements over physical therapy alone, but no range of motion gains as a physical therapy adjunct. Evidence certainty was low to very low for all positive findings, and technique variability, including volumes ranging from 8.3 to 200 milliliters, anterior versus posterior approach, and fluoroscopy versus ultrasound guidance, precluded definitive conclusions. One limitation to note is that high heterogeneity combined with low to very low grade certainty ratings means the statistically significant findings cannot be translated into reliable clinical effect estimates. Moving on, Schneider and colleagues published in the Journal of Arthroplasty, titled Periarticular Injection Alone Provides Comparable Early Recovery to Combined Adductor Canal and Infiltration Between the Popliteal Artery and Capsule of the Knee Blocks Following Total Knee Arthroplasty, a Prospective Randomized Trial. Patient-blinded randomized controlled trial randomized 140 primary total knee arthroplasty patients to periarticular injection alone versus adductor canal block plus infiltration between the popliteal artery and capsule plus periarticular injection, with identical total local anesthetic dose of 80 milliliters of 0.25% bupivacaine with epinephrine plus 30 milligrams of ketorolac across groups. Visual analog scale pain, morphine milligram equivalent opioid consumption, Oxford Knee Score, step counts, and patient satisfaction were monitored daily via remote patient monitoring for 14 postoperative days. No clinically significant between-group differences were identified. The sole statistically significant finding showed a 0.6-point lower visual analog scale score on postoperative day 1 in the periarticular injection-only group, which did not meet the pre-specified 1-point minimum clinically important difference. One limitation to note is that follow-up limited to 14 postoperative days precludes assessment of whether block strategy influences functional recovery milestones, such as discharge readiness, 6-week range of motion, or return to activity. Moving on, Fadley and colleagues published in the Journal of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, titled A Scoping Review of the RIST Trial and Its Sub-Analyses, Implications for Care of Elderly Distal Radius Fractures. This scoping review synthesized all publications derived from the RIST randomized controlled trial, which compared casting, closed reduction, and percutaneous pinning, external fixation, and volar locked plating for distal radius fractures in elderly patients. No significant differences in functional outcomes existed between operative and non-operative treatment at 12 months. Volar locked plating showed superior early recovery at 6 weeks. Complications were most frequent in the casting group. Malunion did not correlate with inferior outcomes, and casting was the most cost-effective strategy, followed by closed reduction and percutaneous pinning. One limitation to note is that the RIST trial enrolled elderly patients at specific activity and functional levels, limiting generalizability to younger or higher demand populations and to fracture patterns not represented in the trial cohort. Moving on, Ahmad and colleagues published in the Journal of Shoulder and Elbow Surgery, titled Effectiveness of Intramedullary Nailing versus Locked Plating, Open Reduction and Internal Fixation in Adult Displaced Proximal Humerus Fractures, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. This PRISMA 2020 compliant meta-analysis compared intramedullary nail versus locked plating for displaced proximal humerus fractures in adults, using 12 randomized controlled trials and cohort studies. no statistically or clinically significant differences were found in disabilities of the arm, shoulder, and hand score, American shoulder and elbow surgeon score, or constant Mirley scores at 6 or 12 months, nor in visual analog scale pain, external rotation, forward flexion, complication rates, or reoperation rates. Subgroup analyses by fracture part, including two-part and three-part fractures, likewise showed no outcome differences between techniques. One limitation to note is that moderate overall evidence quality with inter-study heterogeneity in study design and outcome reporting instruments limits the strength of equivalence conclusions. Moving on. Sullivan and colleagues published in the Journal of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, titled Evaluation of a Novel Educational Three-Dimensionally Printed, Unstable, Distal Radius Fracture Model for Reduction and Splinting. This study evaluated construct validity and educational utility of a novel 3D printed unstable distal radius fracture model by testing 33 residents across all postgraduate year levels from multiple institutions. 14 PGY1 residents were block randomized to model-based teaching versus no exposure before a standardized testing session assessing global rating scale, objective structured assessment of technical skills, procedure time, final radiographic sagittal tilt. Taught PGY1 residents outperformed untrained PGY1s on global rating scale. PGY1s without prior exposure had longer procedure times than all senior residents. And postgraduate year level correlated with global rating scale scores, examination performance, and procedure times, confirming construct validity. One limitation to note is that the primary outcome improvement in global rating scale was demonstrated only in PGY1s with approximately 7 per group, and no objective radiographic or objective structured assessment of technical skills differences were detected, leaving the clinical magnitude of skill transfer unquantified. Moving on, Ang and colleagues published in the Journal of Arthroplasty, titled Liposomal Bupivacaine in Periarticular Injection Cocktails for Pain Management After Total Knee Arthroplasty, a systematic review of randomized controlled trials. This PRESMA-compliant systematic review of 8 high-quality randomized controlled trials evaluated liposomal bupivacaine delivered via periarticular injection versus non-liposomal bupivacaine or multimodal cocktails in primary total knee arthroplasty. Liposomal bupivacaine improved early pain control in 5 of 8 trials, predominantly within the first 24 hours, with several trials also demonstrating reduced opioid consumption and higher patient satisfaction. Functional recovery metrics, including ambulation and discharge readiness, showed variable benefit, and no trial reported inferior outcomes with liposomal bupivacaine. One limitation to note is that heterogeneity in periarticular injection cocktail composition across trials prevents determination of whether liposomal bupivacaine's benefit is independent of or synergistic with co-administered agents such as ketorolac, epinephrine, or corticosteroids. Moving on, Krauss and colleagues published in Spine Journal, titled Transforaminal Endoscopic Lumbar Discectomy versus Interlaminar Endoscopic Lumbar Discectomy for Lumbar Disc Herniations, a prospective multi-center study of recovery trajectories using high-frequency patient-reported outcome measures. This prospective multi-center study compared recovery trajectories after transforaminal endoscopic lumbar discectomy versus interlaminar endoscopic lumbar discectomy using high-frequency patient-reported outcome measures collected daily in week 1 and at fixed intervals through 12 months. Interlaminar endoscopic lumbar discectomy showed faster early recovery with adjusted Oswestry Disability Index differences peaking at -6.14 points at 6 months, but trajectories converged by 12 months. Body mass index and disc morphology were stronger outcome predictors than surgical approach. One limitation to note is that the non-randomized design with systematic case allocation by pathology type, foraminal herniation preferentially treated with transforaminal endoscopic lumbar discectomy, and L5-S1 central or paracentral with interlaminar endoscopic lumbar discectomy confounds the between-group comparison despite multivariable adjustment. Moving on, Griffiths and colleagues published in the Journal of Pediatric Orthopedics, titled Psychological Resilience in Children with Lower Limb Deformities, a Multicenter Quality of Life Study. This prospective cross-sectional multicenter study examined whether lower limb reconstruction severity assessment index deformity complexity scores, correlate with pediatric outcomes data collection instrument measured health-related quality of life in children aged 5 to 18 with lower limb deformities across three international centers. Deformity complexity showed strong negative correlations with most pediatric outcomes data collection instrument domains, with the largest effect in sports and physical function at R equals negative 0.59, and scores were significantly below published pediatric norms. Adolescent self-reported happiness did not correlate with deformity complexity and was statistically similar to general population norms, indicating psychological resilience. One limitation to note is that cross-sectional design captures a single time point and cannot determine whether observed adolescent happiness resilience persists through or after surgical reconstruction, which is the period of greatest psychological stress in this population. Moving on, Raj and colleagues published in Spine Journal titled, "What Functional Benefits Can Older Patients Expect After Adult Spinal Deformity Surgeries?" Sub-analysis from the prospective evaluation of elderly deformity surgery study with 5-year follow-up. This post-hoc sub-analysis of the prospective evaluation of elderly deformity surgery study evaluated functional outcomes in patients age 60 and older undergoing 5 or more level spinal fusion for adult spinal deformity across 12 international centers using Scoliosis Research Society 22 revised function domain and Oswestry Disability Index mobility subscores. Scoliosis Research Society 22 revised function scores improved from 2.70 preoperatively to 3.46 at 2 years and 3.39 at 5 years. The proportion of patients who were bedbound or had primarily no activity dropped from 44.9% to 17.4% at 5 years, and those able to stand greater than 30 minutes rose from 24.5% to 59.4% at 5 years. One limitation to note is that absence of a non-operative comparator group makes it impossible to determine how much of the functional improvement is attributable to surgery versus the natural course of symptom fluctuation or patient selection bias. Moving on. Morris and colleagues published in the Journal of Shoulder and Elbow Surgery, titled "Glenohumeral Arthritis Impairs Shoulder Mobility and Promotes Dynamic Compensatory Strategies During Overhead Reach." This study quantified glenohumeral motion loss and whole-body kinematic compensation during an overhead reach task in 86 glenohumeral arthritis patients using motion capture laboratory analysis, comparing symptomatic to contralateral asymptomatic shoulders. The symptomatic shoulder showed 38 degrees less flexion, 22 degrees less internal rotation, and 4 degrees less abduction. Compensatory strategies included tripling of lumbar rotation from 3 degrees to 9 degrees, contralateral pelvic rotation from 2 degrees to 6 degrees, halved cervical flexion from 18 degrees to 9 degrees, and a 22-degree increase in elbow flexion from 4 degrees to 26 degrees. One limitation to note is that cross-sectional design prevents determination of whether compensatory kinematic patterns resolve after total shoulder arthroplasty or become fixed movement habits requiring independent rehabilitation. Moving on. Kriechling and colleagues published in the Journal of Shoulder and Elbow Surgery, titled "Long-Term Clinical and Radiologic Outcomes of Primary Reverse Total Shoulder Arthroplasty at a Minimum Follow-Up of 15 Years." This study analyzed a prospectively maintained reverse total shoulder arthroplasty database from a tertiary center to determine clinical, radiographic, and survival outcomes at a minimum 15-year follow-up. Kaplan-Meier analysis of 258 shoulders showed 76% complication-free and 84% reoperation-free survival at 15 years, with younger age, female sex, and revision indication as independent risk factors for complications. In the 52 shoulders with complete long-term data, functional gains achieved at 2 years were maintained through 15 years across nearly all metrics, with the exception of forward flexion, which declined from 130 degrees to 115 degrees. Radiographic changes plateaued after 10 years. One limitation to note is that only 20% of the original cohort completed full clinical and radiographic assessment at 15 years, making functional outcome data susceptible to survivorship bias and limiting generalizability of the recorded scores. Moving on. Den and colleagues published in the Journal of Shoulder and Elbow Surgery, titled quality of surgical technique in patients with a humeral shaft fracture in the Hummer study, an international survey among expert surgeons. This sub-study of the Hummer trial asked whether expert-rated surgical technique quality, classified as good or sufficient, versus poor, per AO Foundation principles, in operatively treated humeral shaft fractures, correlates with functional outcomes and complications. 16 orthopedic trauma surgeons from 7 countries independently rated radiographs of 245 operative cases. Good technique was associated with superior constant Rowley score, faster disabilities of the arm, shoulder, and hand score improvement, better shoulder and forearm range of motion, and a non-union rate of 3% versus 26% in poorly performed cases. However, no significant difference in overall complication rates or reoperations was found between good and poor technique groups in direct comparison. One limitation to note is that the study does not define or quantify what specific technical errors constituted poor technique, preventing surgeons from identifying correctable intraoperative factors that drive the outcome differences. Randall and colleagues published in the Journal of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, titled Risk and Timing of Total Knee Arthroplasty After High Tibial Osteotomy, a cohort study with 10-year follow-up. This study quantified total knee arthroplasty conversion rates and risk factors after high tibial osteotomy in 207 patients with a mean age of 41.3 years, treated at a single academic center from 1996 to 2015. Overall total knee arthroplasty conversion was 9.9%, with incidence rising from 5.9% at 10 years to 22.0% at 20 years. Older age at high tibial osteotomy and higher body mass index were significantly associated with conversion, with body mass index independently predictive on modified Poisson regression at a relative risk of 1.13. One limitation to note is that absence of high tibial osteotomy technique details and osteotomy type limits the ability to identify modifiable surgical factors influencing conversion risk. Moving on, Mzehem and colleagues published in the Journal of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, titled Implant-Related Complications After Robotic-Assisted versus Manual Revision Knee Arthroplasty, a Propensity-Matched Cohort Study. This study used the TrinetX Collaborative Network to compare implant-related complications between robotic-assisted and manual revision total knee arthroplasty after one-to-one propensity score matching for demographics, comorbidities, and revision history. Robotic-assisted revision total knee arthroplasty showed significantly lower mechanical implant-related complications at 3 and 6 months, lower instability at 1 year, and lower opioid use throughout 3 years of follow-up. Periprosthetic joint infection, readmission, patellar dislocation, wound infection, and transfusion rates did not differ, but manual revision total knee arthroplasty had a higher 3-year revision rate of 13.5% versus 11.4%. One limitation to note is that the database methodology cannot capture bone loss grade, implant constraint level, or revision indication, all of which are primary determinants of revision total knee arthroplasty outcome and likely differ systematically between robotic and manual cohorts despite propensity matching. Moving on, Frappa and colleagues published in Spine Journal, titled Association Between Antidepressant Use and Pseudarthrosis Following Spinal Fusion, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. This systematic review and meta-analysis asked whether antidepressant use increases pseudarthrosis risk after cervical or lumbar spinal fusion across 5 observational studies. Random effects pooling showed antidepressants overall increased pseudarthrosis odds at 1.53, 95% confidence interval, 1.17 to 2.01, with serotonergic agents driving a stronger signal at 2.26, 95% confidence interval, 1.18 to 4.33. Heterogeneity was substantial, and directionally consistent effects were seen in both cervical and lumbar subgroups. One limitation to note is that substantial heterogeneity across only 5 observational studies limits confidence in the pooled estimate and prevents reliable dose or duration response conclusions. Moving on, Vanderhoek and colleagues published in the Journal of Pediatric Orthopedics, titled Variety is Not the Spice of Life: Inconsistent Definitions of Failure After Hip Reconstruction in Cerebral Palsy, This PRISMA-compliant systematic review of 630 screened abstracts with 27 included studies examined how failure is defined after bony hip reconstruction in cerebral palsy patients and compiled reported failure rates. Reimer migration percentage thresholds were used in 63% of studies and revision surgery in 48%, with additional definitions including arthritis or pain at 18.5% and lateral center edge angle at 18.5%. The 40-fold range in failure rates from 1.8% to 74% directly reflects definitional inconsistency rather than true outcome differences, precluding meta-analysis. One limitation to note is that overlapping patient cohorts from two institutions contributing 6 publications introduce the risk of duplicate patient counting, which could distort pooled failure rate estimates. Moving on, Lakpriya and colleagues published in the Journal of Arthroplasty titled Etiology of Failure in Revision Total Knee Arthroplasty, a systematic review and meta-analysis. This systematic review and meta-analysis examined re-revision rates and failure etiologies across 16 studies published from 2014 to 2025, encompassing 39,723 revision total knee arthroplasties. The pooled re-revision rate was 13.5%. Periprosthetic joint infection was the leading cause of failure at 27.5%. 95% confidence interval, 26.4 to 28.8, followed by instability at 13.6%, aseptic loosening at 12.8%, arthrofibrosis at 9.4%, unexplained pain at 8.0%, and periprosthetic fracture at 7.6%. Substantial heterogeneity was present across included studies. One limitation to note is that substantial heterogeneity across the 16 included studies without stratification by constraint level, prior revision indication, or time to re-revision prevents identification of modifiable surgical factors driving the 13.5% re-revision rate. Moving on, Rudran and colleagues published in the British Journal of Surgery titled Glucagon-like peptide 1 receptor agonists are associated with improved 90-day outcomes after total hip and knee arthroplasty, a systematic review and meta-analysis. This PRISMA-compliant systematic review and meta-analysis of 10 matched cohort studies evaluated whether preoperative GLP-1 receptor agonist use reduces 90-day complications after primary total hip arthroplasty and total knee arthroplasty in diabetic and obese patients. GLP-1 receptor agonist use was associated with lower 90-day surgical complications, medical complications, and readmissions. Subgroup analysis showed significantly stronger effects in total hip arthroplasty versus total knee arthroplasty, where only readmission rate was significantly reduced. Grade assessment rated evidence as very low for all outcomes except healthcare cost, driven by the observational design of all included studies. One limitation to note is that all included studies are matched cohort designs with moderate to serious risk of bias, making confounding by indication an unresolved threat to validity. Moving on, Nesbitt and colleagues published in Clinical Orthopedics and Related Research titled Can a Targeted Dissemination Strategy of the PREPARE Trial Results Change Surgical Antiseptic Practice? Low-cost dissemination strategy could accelerate adoption of the PREPARE trial's finding that iodine povacrylex outperforms chlorhexidine alcohol for fracture surgery skin preparation. At a single level 1 trauma center, a multifaceted intervention including surgeon and nursing education, posted reminders, and supply chain support was implemented in February 2024 and compared against a 4-year pre-intervention baseline. Iodine povacrylex use jumped from 0.8% to 86% immediately post-dissemination, with no significant decay over 17 months. Fellowship-trained trauma surgeons adopted at 94.8% versus 34.7% for non-fellowship-trained surgeons. One limitation to note is that the study measures antiseptic adoption as a process metric only. Without concurrent surgical site infection tracking, it cannot confirm that the practice change produced the infection reduction benefit observed in the PREPARE trial. Moving on, Sogbein and colleagues published in the Journal of Shoulder and Elbow Surgery, titled Proximal Humerus Fractures Treated with Single or Dual Plate Constructs, a Comparison of Clinical Outcomes. This single-institution retrospective cohort compared complications and reoperations in proximal humerus fracture patients treated with single versus dual plate open reduction and internal fixation from 2010 to 2025. Dual plate constructs demonstrated significantly lower varus cutout at 3.1% versus 14.6%, non-union at 0% versus 9.3%, and reoperation rates at 5.4% versus 22.7%. Regression analysis identified high energy mechanism as an independent predictor of reoperation, and dual plating as protective against reoperation. One limitation to note is that significantly higher rate of supplemental allograft use in the dual plate group was not controlled for in the primary analysis, making it impossible to attribute the mechanical advantage solely to the dual plate construct. And finally, Golubovsky and colleagues published in Spine Journal, titled A Retrospective Cohort Analysis Evaluating the Utility of the Spinal Instability Neoplastic Score in Screening for Spinal Instability and Vertebral Compression Fracture Risk in Plasma Cell Neoplasm and Lymphoma Lesions. This single-institution retrospective cohort evaluated whether the Spinal Instability Neoplastic Score correlates with instability and vertebral compression fracture progression, specifically in plasma cell neoplasm and lymphoma spinal lesions. Higher spinal instability neoplastic score independently predicted instability and vertebral compression fracture progression. Bisphosphonate and RANK-L inhibitor use was protective against vertebral compression fracture. Despite statistical correlation, 20 of 27 surgical patients fell in the possibly unstable category, and the spinal instability neoplastic score did not predict neurological status, raising concern that current thresholds over-triage radiosensitive histologies to surgery. One limitation to note is that the 3-month follow-up window is insufficient to capture reossification after radiotherapy in radiosensitive histologies, which may have led to overestimation of true instability rates in this cohort. That wraps up this week's Ortho Digest Rundown, 25 studies reviewed. Head to orthodigest.com for the full write-ups.